Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and myself, Tris Dixon. Gents, this week we have put together a list of fantasy fights. And it's funny, in the trade, a lot of people are wary about doing this, I think, in case people's feelings get hurt, and because it's so hard to talk about different eras overlapping. So I think it's first and foremost, it's important to realize that this is a bit of fun and obviously highly hypothetical. I mean, we've talked about heavyweight greats fighting each other and all the rest of it, so there's no right or wrong to any of this, but it's just based on our experiences and thoughts and feelings, really. Ian, I mean, it's fanboy nonsense, this, but it's fun nonsense nonetheless.
Oh, it's great fun nonsense, and I think the bill we've got here is the greatest bill ever put together. I don't think Don King or Bob Arum or Frank Warren or Eddie Hearn or anybody ever put together a bill as good as this. You could charge £999.99 pay-per-view for the five fights that we're going to talk about here. Yeah, it's great for the imagination. As you say, it is a bit of fun, but of course, the people concerned aren't going to treat it like that, because we are going to deliver a verdict of what we think would have happened in the five fights. So the first one is Tris.
So the first one we've got is Prince Nassim Hamed against the Clonus Cyclone, Barry McGuigan. It is a fight for the ages. I mean, there was no overlap, but it is something that when Naz came through, people did talk about it a little bit, didn't they, John?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, for people of the previous generation, if you like, or the previous generation of fight fans, McGuigan was the man who really inspired the country. You know, huge mass popular appeal. And at a time, of course, when Northern Ireland was torn apart by the Troubles, and Barry was a huge unifying factor and was immensely popular on both sides of the Irish Sea. When he went on to win the world title in 1985, it got colossal television audience and a very big live gate at the Queen's Park Rangers football ground. And it was, you know, he was the man of his era, really, I suppose, in terms of popular appeal. And then when Naz came through, Naz had an appeal which kind of transcended boxing. It brought in a new audience to an extent. He became almost rock and roll as well as a sportsman. And he was a flamboyant character. He was box office. And so the pair of them had had this huge appeal. So, yeah, I mean, we've spent many a lunch and a beer and a dinner talking over this sort of fight. And this is one which, you know, I mean, everybody would have wanted to see this.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it had been as his flashy, unconventional skills and power, wouldn't it, against Barry's great left hook and how busy he was in his fights, always probing for openings. Do you know something? I'll just throw something into the mix here. I think for the purposes of our little fairy tale exercise today, we've got to assume that these would be neutral venues. But I think the outcome might have been different if this was the King's Hall, Belfast. That might be a big influence, mightn't it? Because Barry fighting there was kind of unstoppable.
Barry's fans would have travelled. You put this on where you like. You know, we're talking about putting this on in Saudi Arabia with big money to finance the dream fights. You know, I mean, his fans from Belfast and the rest of Ireland would have travelled anywhere, I think, for this sort of fight.
Mind you, talking about location, it's worth noting here that both came unstuck in Las Vegas.
Yep. Yeah,
I think there was more of an excuse for Barry coming unstuck in Las Vegas, wasn't there? Putting him on open air against a Mexican, a swarthy-skinned Mexican in the heat of the Nevada sunshine. You know, I mean, Naz lost in an indoor arena, air conditioned, and climate had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Yeah, but he was fighting Marco Antonio Barrera, and Barry was fighting Steve Cruz, who nobody'd ever heard of. So, come on, I'd have to slightly disagree with you, John.
I wasn't questioning the standard of bloke who he fought. I was merely saying that it was not the same conditions.
Darkie catches John on the break there with the left hook out of the clinch.
Fairy tale fight. Dark v. Rawling, which... As the referee, like Wyatt Earp used to do all those. Well,
hey, by the way, I like the storyline here. I like what John said at the start, in the sense that obviously we know that Barry was such a unifying factor, and Ian Naz was so divisive, wasn't he?
Well, I suppose he was. I mean, he would never have it. I remember doing interviews with him when I worked for Sky Sports, saying, you know, kind of hinting that a lot of people bought the tickets to see this pretty cocky little featherweight dumped on the seat of his pants and getting beaten. And I said, wait, but it doesn't matter why they buy the tickets. They want to see you. I mean, it was the same with Chris Eubank and a few other fighters you could name down the years. So it didn't matter. But Naz wouldn't have that. He thought he was the massive number one hit for the Generation X, I think it was called at the time. But it doesn't matter really about what the popularity stakes was. I mean, it would come down in the end, wouldn't it, Tris, to who had the technical ability to win the fight.
Yeah, and I suppose, John, when you look at this fight, when you look at the styles, you know, they you know, Barry was talented, and he could outbox some of the better guys. He didn't have to go in the trenches every time, but he was comfortable in the trenches. I'm not sure. But then obviously Naz had that wild up and downer with Kevin Kelly, didn't he, in Madison Square Garden. But then he could also stink the place out like he did against Cesar Soto in Detroit. So it's a tough one. Barry wasn't in many stinkers from what I recall. But I don't know. I mean, how does this fight start to unfold, John? If they're in there, McGuigan and Naz looking for these big shots and Barry trying to get busy, how do you see it breaking down?
Well, it's Naz with the explosive punch power that we've talked about, because for a man of, what was he, 5 foot four and a half, he had extraordinary power in both hands, really. He was a natural southpaw, but he's one of the most comfortable switch hitters that I've ever seen in a boxing ring. He had that power, but he relied increasingly on the power to cover for maybe a lack of stamina. And at times, he'd probably argue the toss on this, but at times maybe a lack of technical proficiency. You know, against Marco Antonio Barrera, I know we shouldn't judge him on one fight, and he had good wins against the likes of Kevin Kelly, Tom Johnson, Steve Robinson. But against Marco Antonio Barrera, he was flummoxed by a man who he thought was going to be the aggressor coming at him, who actually didn't really do that. He fought more as a counterpuncher, Barrera, and that was what flummoxed Naz. And, you know, I think against Barry, it would be easy to dismiss Barry McGuigan as a one-dimensional fighter. I don't believe he was. And I think that he'd have had a game plan. I think that they've worked long and hard on it, and it wouldn't have just been the natural aggressor with the big left hook against the fancy switch hitter with the big punch. I think there'd have been many more technical, tactical wrinkles in the fight than you might imagine.
Yeah, I think, you know, these are two Hall of Famers. You know, they're both inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame, one of a very small contingent of UK inductees. It's interesting. I mean, with Barry, I think, Ian, when you look at him, Barry has the best win out of the two of them, right? And maybe even you could argue the second or third best win when you look at Taylor and Laporte. Like, those are outstanding wins that he's notched. And when you look at Naz, and, you know, there was the case of Kevin Kelly maybe being a bit past it, Tom Johnson being past it, and you know, Steve Robinson was obviously a Cinderella man who had that purple patch that came to an end with Naz. you could say that McGuigan's wins are more impressive than Nassim's, right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument. I think when he beat Laporte in the King's Hall, that was probably Barry at his peak before he won the weight title. I think Barry probably admit that himself. I think he became a little tight at the weight, at featherweight, even before the Pedroza fight. Pedroza had, I think, 19 defenses. He's a beautiful fighter. But maybe he was just a tad, not much, just a tad past his very, very best. And Barry, dropped him and beat him over 15 rounds at Queen's Park Rangers. Two great wins. Barry had the dehydration problem with Steve Cruz, and there were other problems in the camp around that. But I think it's fair to say, too, there were a lot of problems with Naz around the time that he lost to Barrera. The approach was amateurish. I remember speaking to people in the camp, and they said, oh, he'll just knock Barrera out, because Junior Jones had done something like that with him. And I said, well, hang on, that's the only time that ever happened with Barrera. So what's the plan about beating him if you have to do it on points? Well, they didn't really have one. I know Emmanuel Stewart came into the camp quite late with only 2 weeks to go. He looked at Naz. I don't think he really made the weight that well for the fight either. He was worried, I think, from the moment he saw Naz. So I think we've got to take it, haven't we, in coming to our verdict, which we'll need to do, I think, pretty shortly here. That it's the Naz around the time of the Kevin Kelly fight, or when he was with Brendan Ingle, he was better with Brendan Ingle, and Barry around the time of the Laporte and Pedroza fights, and then you pays your money and takes your choice, I guess.
Which way are you going then, Ian?
Right, my verdict, and I wrote this down before our discussion, is that Barry builds up a quite handy points lead in the fight, but Naz's power gets to him. And I've got Nazim Hamed by late stoppage.
John?
Well, I don't go along with that. I think that Naz against Barry might have struggled with stamina, because I think his best chance against Barry was to knock him out early. And I don't think that he would have been able to find a way to do that. I think McGuigan would have been maybe just that little bit too physical, too strong, too game, and too incessant in his work rate. And I'm going McGuigan on points.
Oh, I like this. I've gone somewhere in between you both, really. I have gone for a Naz stoppage on cuts, because I've recently spoken to Jim McDonnell, who beat Barry on cuts. I've gone for Naz on cuts, but while behind on points. So he's clawed out some rocket launchers from somewhere, maybe not landed clean, but done enough damage, and it's stopped on cuts in the championship rounds.
Split decision in favour of Prince Nassim Hamed. Barry will never talk to us again.
He'll talk to me.
I was going to say Naz won't talk to you anyway, but obviously you formed a relationship since then.
Oh, I know. I told you about my coffee shop meeting with him a couple of years.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Old chat. It was about old times.
Yeah, you can find that in our Naz archive issue for anyone who wants to go back through the archives. So talking of cuts, we're going on to Alan Minter next in fight two. And he is up against Chris Eubank, Brighton's own Chris Eubank at middleweight. Ian, I mean, I know you saw plenty of both. You certainly saw far more of both of these than me. So you lead off this time, and I'll get John to lead us off in the next one.
Well, Chris Eubank can tell you off, because he always said, I'm from Hove, not Brighton.
True.
Although, didn't he become sort of a lord of the manor of Brighton or something later on? Well, I loved covering Chris Eubank. Alan Minter was even, it was this long ago that, I only caught the tail end, really, of his career in my time as a commentator. I think, he became slightly underrated, didn't he? Alan Minter, I think, he won the undisputed middleweight title against Vito Antuofermo, defended it against him, and he was really unlucky that the guy coming along around that time was Marvin Hagler, who came and beat him and ripped the title away on that riotous night at Wembley back in 1980. But you look back at Alan's career, yeah, I mean, there were setbacks, but I think he had a lot of hard fights, three with Kevin Finnegan, domestic big classic fights, which he came out on top of. They were close fights. You know, he was put in with Ronnie Harris, who was president of the, you know, who needs him club. They should never have made that match. And Alan got beaten in eight rounds. And he tended to be, people tended to pour cold water on what he did. But he was undisputed middleweight champion, you know, out of the southpaw stance. But he did have the problem you alluded to with the cuts. Well, Chris is more recent. Of course, we know about his long, long reign, his artistry, his eccentricity, you know, his power and his fantastic chin. So this is another good fight, isn't it?
Yeah, John, where are you with this? I mean, does it jump off the page as a thriller to you or a close one?
Well, Alan Minter, I mean, I never actually saw him at ringside, Alan Minter. I watched him on television, of course, as many of the people listening to this would have done. And he was very talented. He came off a long and successful amateur career, and he was a very good technician. But as Ian said, he had that tendency to cut. And, you know, he went along to a Harley Street specialist to go and seek advice on this, to try and find if there are ways to toughen his skin and make him more resilient and stop him losing on cuts, because he lost three in very quick succession at one stage. And the Harley Street specialist said to him, well, the reason you're getting cut is you're getting hit too much. Alan said, well, thank you very much for that. That's 500 quid down the pan. But he was a good fighter. And you mentioned Kevin Finnegan, who he said he thought was one of the very best fighters he ever shared the ring with. Very talented and very underrated. And yeah, and the wins against Vito and to Affirmo, and the unluckiness to fight at his prime, you know, a phenomenal fighter like Marvin Hagler. And then when he got beaten by Tony Simpson, that was time for him to walk away. Eubank, I always had a huge regard for his toughness, his resilience, and his showmanship. He was great box office. You know, the time when he bestrode British boxing, he almost kept it going single-handed, because Frank Bruno had been beaten by Tyson and had fallen away. He didn't get another title shot until very much later against Oliver McCall. And during that period in the early 90s, Nigel Benn, but predominantly Chris Eubank, held British boxing really together. And I think against a fighter like Minter, I think his toughness would have been all important. But he did used to go walkabout in fights, didn't he? When he was standing, posturing by the ropes, looking out into the crowd, tapping his gloves together. A lot of that, I think, was due to the fact that he wasn't comfortable fighting 3 minutes of every round. And that's what Steve Collins ultimately exploited to beat him twice in those fights over in Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, work rate was a problem, wasn't it, for Chris? Just for the reasons you explained, Johnny. I mean, he coasted through parts of rounds. Often his fights weren't that great, really. And he got one or two decisions, I think, that were, well, let's just say arguable during that reign.
Ian, let me ask
Dan
you.
Dan Shomer
in South Africa, yeah.
Well, there was the Ray Close one as well, wasn't there? There was a couple. So let me ask you this. Could Alan, who I think had about 23 or 24 knockouts in 39 wins, could he put a dent in Eubank, who had a great chin?
Well, I think that's the problem. I could see Alan maybe getting ahead on points and being busy in the fight. But, you know, I think we haven't really talked about Chris Eubank's great win when they were both young over Nigel Benn, you know, the 1990 Classic at the NEC in Birmingham. What a victory. I think that was everything Eubank was at his very best, paraded on that night. And he stopped Ben, who went on, of course, to have a great career of his own as a world champion. So that is very, very high in your thinking, I think, in assessing this fight, even though he had those setbacks later on in his career against Steve Collins and I think Carl Thompson a couple of times at the end. But
it's probably worth mentioning the Michael Watson fight as well here, which obviously we know was tragic, but where Eubank was hurt and then climbed off the deck and turned things around tragically. I mean, you can't count him out at all, can you, Chris?
He was immensely hard. He was a very, very tough man. You know, I mean, he was obviously managed well. There were fighters who he didn't fight. He didn't fight Harold Graham. He went nowhere near Roy Jones, you know, and for obvious reasons. They were slippery movers who wouldn't have been at all suited to his style. But the fighters who he put in against, and if he was in against somebody regarded as a bit of a puncher like Alan Minter, who would have gone, you know, he'd have been only too happy to have tried to wage a war with Chris Eubank. I think fighters like that really were made for him, and that really played to his very great strength, which was indeed his strength.
So, yeah, John, I mean, which way are you going then, John?
I'm going Eubank points. I think Minter could have got ahead earlier on if his face held up, which is a big if. He goes the distance, but I think he'd have been, by the end, I think he'd have been well behind on points.
Ian?
I've got exactly the same. Chris Eubank on points, and maybe a cut stoppage if Minter had a bad night with his skin, and he often did.
I'm with you. I've got Eubank points, and I've already used my cuts card, so I couldn't reuse it. So it points it is. Okay, so third fight. John, let's get you started with this because I know you saw plenty of both. We have Welsh icon Joe Calzaghe against the pride of Nottingham, Carl Froch. It kind of almost happened, but it never did happen. And for me, it was a fight I was never really into because they just didn't quite overlap prime for prime for me. But John, how do you see this one going? Calzaghe v. Froch.
Well, you'd have wanted to see them at their prime, wouldn't you? You'd have wanted to see the Calzaghe who fought Jeff Lacy and Kessler, and the Froch who beat Lucien Boutet, maybe, or found the way to win the rematch against Kessler. You'd have wanted to see them in their prime, and I think this is pretty clearly the speed and the punch stats that Calzaghe produced against the power and resilience and sheer will to win of Carl Froch. I think it's a great fight on paper for those reasons. And people who are committed one way or the other as supporters over the years of these two guys, they're very, 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 very firm on their belief that their man could do it. And still to this day, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you were talking to Carl Froch now, right now, he'd say, yeah, I could have done it. He didn't hit hard enough. I'd have had enough to stay with him and to find a way. And I was more of a fighter than he was. Calzaghe, I think he'd have echoed what his dad used to say and what Frank Warren have always said, that he would hit him three times while Carl Froch was thinking what to do. That was the sort of the mindset of the two fighters who, let me just say at this point, were absolutely superb champions, both in their own right.
Yeah, again, Ian, there's not many Brits in the Hall of Fame. And it's worth pointing out here that John Rawlin was on the ballot this year, which is an achievement in itself. But again, here we've got two Brits who are in the Hall of Fame in Joe Calzaghe and Carl Froch. It's tough, isn't it? Because Froch paid all those dues on the road. Calzaghe was more made out of Wales, and certainly in the UK. But I suppose this one doesn't really come down to venue at all, I don't think.
No, I mean, I've got all the respect in the world for what Carl Froch did in the ring. I think he was an ultimate British warrior. You know, he didn't duck anything, did he? He was in that WBC or that Super Six thing that they did. He had that hard win over Jean Pascal. He beat Jermaine Taylor in that amazing final round, turning the fight around. He beat Andro Dural. He beat Kessler. You know, came a cropper against Andre Ward. I was ringside for that. Ward was just too strong for him on that night. I remember Carl saying at the airport the next morning to me, I couldn't believe how strong he was on the inside. So I think Ward was something special at his best. That's a bit of a side issue. So I think Froch gives anyone, including Calzaghe, a very, very hard night indeed. Probably anyone in history around his weight. But John touched on it there. A big thing with Joe Calzaghe, of course, went unbeaten right the way through his career, 46-0 with 32 knockouts, was that hand speed. it was a blurring hand speed. I mean, and what he did to Jeff Lacy that night. I mean, the Americans fancied Lacy. I think the bookmakers even had Lacy as favorite. And Calzaghe didn't only beat him in every round, he won every second of every round as well. It was a spellbinding performance. And of course, the late career wins over Kessler and Bernard Hopkins and Roy Jones Jr. But it took him a long time, really, I think, to become a big star, didn't it, Joe? But he always found a way in the end. I mean, even when he was down against, I think he was down against Byron Mitchell, wasn't he? Got up to win that as well. So what a fight. I'd have loved to have seen it.
Mind you, you talk about it took him a while to become an overnight success, Joe. It wasn't too dissimilar for Frotch, wasn't it? A lot of those fights, he was in the wilderness on ITV4 and whatever, yeah. And, you know, on prime time and all the rest of it. Until he aligned himself with Matchroom and Sky, he was really struggling for that recognition. And it was at the end when he beat Kessler and, well, I think it was Butte, Kessler, and had the two huge Groves fights where he became, you know, the star he's become. By the way, it's also probably worth noting here, I think both of these guys could be versatile. I mean, when Frotch beat Arthur Abraham, he made Abraham look terribly one-dimensional and completely peppered him and outboxed him in Helsinki. I remember that night, one of the best performances I've seen by a Brit on the road ever. And Calzaghe was also incredibly versatile. I think for about 6 or 7 or 8 rounds, he was, you know, neck and neck with Kessler. But he found something else, and he changed things up, and he went to the body a little bit more and took on instructions from Enzo Calzaghe. And by the way, it's worth noting the trainers here. Frotch had his lifelong relationship with McCracken, and Enzo was with Joe every step of the way. So two real stalwarts in the corner as well. But God, it's tough, isn't it? You don't want to pick against Frotch, but for me, and I suppose I'll set off early with this, and I spoke to Frotch about this when he was inducted in the Hall of Fame earlier this year. He was actually full of praise for Calzaghe out there. It was very refreshing, and he knows what Calzaghe brought to the table, and while I don't think he ever conceded that he would have lost, he knows it would have been probably the best guy he ever fought. And I would, along with Ward, go along with that, and I would see Calzaghe's work. I don't think anyone's getting stopped in this fight, but I think Calzaghe's work rate would set him apart and he would win on points. Ian, where are you in this?
Well, what I've written down and before we have the discussion was Calzaghe by an arguable contentious split decision.
Ooh, I like that.
I think it'd be one of those. It would have been well worth watching. And I think probably Frotch and his fan club would probably be arguing that they'd nicked it. But Joe just on his work rate, I think, and hand speed.
Worth talking about Joe's toughness as well, by the way. Obviously, everyone knows about Frotch's grit and all the rest of it. Calzaghe could hang with the best of them, couldn't he, John?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was a very, very tough man, Joe Calzaghe, you know, beating the likes of Brewer. You mentioned Mitchell, the fight against Lacy, against Kessler, who was an outstanding fighter.
Yeah.
Really was a very good fighter indeed. And I don't think that Joe gets the credit sometimes that he deserves from that particular fight. And indeed, Carl Frotch, who fought him twice, of course, and in the second time came back and won the rematch and showed himself to be exceptional in his own right. But I think, you know, Mick Hennessy, I remember the promoter of Frotch, saying to me time and again when he was fighting in those little fights which didn't get much coverage, he said, when are you going to recognize how special he is? And I, you know, repeatedly said to him, Mick, I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying, but you can't say he's special until he's fought and beaten somebody of real talent. Well, my goodness, didn't he do that? Frotch just went on and fought absolutely everybody and beat virtually everybody as well. But I think that, you know, styles make fights, and I think the southpaw factor in Calzaghe's favour, plus that astonishing work rate, I'd have gone for Calzaghe on points. I don't think it would have been a landslide, but I think he'd have won by maybe a 2 or 3 point margin.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, you say about the southpaw, I mean, it didn't help Lucien Boutet at all, but when we talk about Calzaghe as well, don't forget, he was only a puppy, really, when he beat Chris Eubank in that war as well. Do you remember that? When he decked Eubank early and Eubank came back and stuck his feet into the canvas and gave Calzaghe a real litmus test, wasn't it, Ian?
I think Joe said after that, and I think he still would tell you that that was his toughest fight, he said, Eubank.
Yeah.
He said nobody hit him harder, didn't he?
Amazing stuff. Right, well, let's go on to the next one. We actually have, we're out of the UK now for this, so the Saudi money's really talking.
Why don't they pay us any of the Saudi money, by the way? we wouldn't accept it, would we, on political grounds?
of course. Hey, John's off. John's packed his bags.
He's off to Riyadh. Yeah,
I didn't get where I was today without an ability to be bought.
Well, what was the line from Bob Sheridan? I think Bob Sheridan, who was on this, a guest, the late Bob Sheridan, who was a guest on this, was, I think I asked him on Boxing Live Stories. I said, weren't you a shill for Don King? He said, you would have been a shill for that money. So anyway, I digress. We've got an all-American heavyweight clash here between, well, it's a battle of hookers, but slightly more than that. We've got Mike Tyson against Smoking Joe Frazier. I think, Ian, this is one of your dream fights, isn't it? So, Ian, do you want to kick us off with this?
Well, I mean, this would be like two locomotives in a head-on collision, wouldn't it? I mean, so what are we talking about? The 1988 Mike Tyson, when he was having his reign of terror on the heavyweight division, around the time he was beating Michael Spinks in 91 seconds and everyone was scared to death of him. And the Joe Frazier of 1971, who beat Muhammad Ali, you know, with his relentlessness. But of course, you have to mix into it with Joe the fact that he was knocked down, lifted off his feet by George Foreman. So I think that plays into what we may decide in our fictional verdict at some later point. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, John, well, Foreman presented a very different set of physical challenges to what Tyson would do against Joe, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're looking at two guys who are very similar in size, in weight, and to an extent in style, although I think Tyson, you know, in his prime, relied more on speed than Joe Frazier. Frazier was just amazingly tough and just kept on coming. You know, the Frazier who fought Ali in 1971 would have been such a handful for anybody who ever lived. I think that was his truly prime performance. But then, you know, Tyson in 1988, the man who scared the living daylights out of Michael Spinks and finished it in no time at all. You know, he had the most amazing aura of intimidation. And I think that would have been undoubtedly a factor. How well would Frazier have coped with that? I think he'd have coped very well, by the way, because I don't think he was the sort of guy to get phased and frightened by too much. But I think physically, they were very, very similar. So that would have made it a great fight to watch.
I mean, Ian, it's you know, the knock on Tyson has always been, I mean, in a nice way of framing it, it's not really who he beat, it's how he beat them. But for Joe, I mean, he just fought them all, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And here's something else that John just alluded to with Frazier. I mean, he wasn't spooked in any way by all the antics of Muhammad Ali. So I don't think he would have been spooked in any way at all by Tyson, remembering what we always say, that a lot of Tyson opponents, including Michael Spinks, were beaten before they started. They just didn't kind of fancy it when it came to it on the night. Frazier wouldn't have cared at all. He'd have just come steaming forward, bobbing and weaving and being quite hard to hit, even though he was coming forward all the time. So Joe was something really to behold, I think. You know, I mean, even Muhammad Ali of 1971 on the comeback trail after his ban for draft dodging or alleged draft dodging, you know, he just had too much for him on that night. So, I mean, I'd have loved to have seen this for as long as it lasted. I'm not sure how long it would have lasted.
Yeah, this isn't going the distance, is it? No way. I think with two people who could punch with the power of these guys, I think that you've got to say that it's going to be a stoppage one way or the other. And as I said, Tyson had the edge in speed and maybe even the edge in one-punch power. But Frazier, if he got through those early rounds and if Tyson couldn't blitz him in the way that George Foreman did, and you know, and as Tris said, Foreman was a very, very different sort of fighter to Tyson or Frazier. If he could have got through those early rounds, Frazier, I think that he might just have broken Mike Tyson's heart in the way that ultimately Evander Holyfield did. Although I do recognise that the Tyson who Holyfield beat was not the Tyson who was coming powering through and blitzing his way through the division between, say, 1985 and 1988.
It's worth noting here, by the way, that Mike Tyson did beat A. Frazier, where he blitzed Marvis in about 30 seconds in Glen Falls, New York, didn't he? And I don't know if you remember, but
no Joe, was he?
I mean, no, but this was the thing. Marvis was no Joe, but this was the thing, right? So Marvis was a smart boxer who had good amateur wins and good amateur pedigree. And then through his early pro career, Joe took the reins a little bit and started to try to turn him into a slugger. And by the time that he fought Tyson, the billing was, you know, is he going to be a slugger against Mike Tyson, which is going to be a recipe for disaster. And so it seemed like everyone could see it apart from Joe, who might have been trying to live vicariously through Marvis and trying to find out who would have won this dream fight if he'd got his hands on Mike Tyson himself. But it obviously didn't work out at all. And like you said, Joe was a very different proposition to Marvis. And I think it's worth that Ali win. There's plenty of people who say that the win over Ali in 1971 in the fight of the century in Madison Square Garden was the greatest single victory from any boxer in history ever.
Wow.
Well, that's a big call, isn't it? You know, because Ali in 1971 wasn't the Ali of 1967.
Yeah.
No, but he was closer to the Ali of 67 than he was when he was still tearing up most people in 72, 73, 74 and 75, though.
But well, I think the big question in this fight that we're talking about is, I mean, John said it there, you know, if Frazier could get through that early phase of the fight, could he? Would he have got through the early phase of the fight? What do you think, Tris?
My gut instinct, I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because you can't say Joe Frazier couldn't be wiped out, because he was wiped out a couple of times. You know, obviously, you know, George Foreman had him like a basketball, didn't he? Up and down. It's tough, though. It's tough because Tyson, it's really, when you start to factor in the level of opposition, it's hard to factor in Mike Tyson doing a job on Joe Frazier. It just is, in my book. And this is from a guy who, you know, following Tyson was one of my great joys as a kid, and obviously led me all the way out to Kevin Rooney's gym in Catskill. But I can't make a case for it. And I think I can't make a case for it, John. I mean, do you see Tyson getting rid of Frazier early?
I think it's the only way he wins. I think if he could get to Frazier with big shots, you know, it's the ones you don't see, isn't it? And Tyson, everybody talks about his power and his explosiveness, but it was, I think, the key for Tyson, which made him so exceptional for those 2 or 3 years, was his speed. But I don't think that speed would have been enough to have beaten Joe Frazier if he hadn't got him very early. I think Frazier would have been too relentless, just too damn tough. And I think that eventually he would have physically, not literally, but I think physically, he'd have broken Mike Tyson's heart. I think that Frazier, for me, would have won by stoppage. Round about the ninth.
Round about when, John?
The ninth.
Ooh, okay, Ian, where are you with this?
Well, I think I'm kind of hedging my bets a bit here. I think the 1988 Tyson was really a force of nature, and I think he would have won early. I think he would have knocked out Frazier in the first 2 or 3 rounds of the fight. But any version of Tyson beyond 1988 doesn't beat Joe Frazier. I think only around that time would he have won it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've leant more towards John and Ian. The nostalgia in me picks up exactly what you're saying about Tyson. I wish he'd been able to have that dance partner that would have really made him a top 5 or 10 heavyweight. But I've got exactly the same round as John, by the way, 9th round for Joe Frazier. And the reason why I'm going for this is people like your Teddy Atlases and others have said the flaws in Tyson's character were always going to be there and they were going to always rear their head at some point or another. And whether it was 1987 or 1988, at that point in his career, if he fought Joe Frazier, there's no telling that he wouldn't have unraveled had he had to dig deep, as he later came up short trying to dig deep in his career. So I'm going for Frazier in 9 rounds, with Tyson sitting out in some way, shape or form, exhausted and disgruntled and forlorn.
Mm-hmm. We'll never know. We'll never know.
We'll never know. But hey, let's go on to the next one. So we've got, it's an all British heavyweight one now, and it's a fascinating one because we're transcending eras, and these guys, I think they've swapped some barbs on social media. It's Lennox Lewis against the heavyweight incumbent Tyson Fury. John, let's start with you. I think, you know, you've covered both of these extensively for Ringside. Not many guys look down on Lennox, but Tyson Fury would have.
Physically, he does. I'm not sure he does any other way. And he doesn't look down on him by so much physically either, because he claims to be 6'9", doesn't he? And I don't believe that. I think he's more like sort of 6'7", 6'7½". And Lennox was 6'5". I don't think there's a huge amount between them in terms of height, although, you know, Tyson is the taller man. What you're talking about is boxing ability, and Fury's boxing ability, I think, is underrated by some people. He can switch hit very effectively. For a man of his size, he's extraordinarily mobile. And as we've seen repeatedly, when in adversity, he finds a way to win. There is the true fighting man within him. So, you know, he again, people who watch him, who are in the fan club, who maybe are listening to this, will be saying, yeah, we go along with what John Fury says. There isn't a man in heavyweight history who could have beaten my son. And he is a terrific fighter. You know, people forget that he beat Vladimir Klitschko. Never mind those fights against Deontay Wilder. He beat a decent Klitschko and he worked out how to do it and had the tactics to do so. So to totally disregard his chances in a fight against Lennox Lewis, I think would be a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking, I think, a big battle of wits and skills, aren't we, between these two. I'm with you, John. He is underrated, Tyson Fury. I mean, I must admit, early on in his career, I wasn't particularly sold on the fact that he was going to become some kind of modern great. But, you know, the win over Vladimir Klitschko was a brilliant performance, really, from beginning to end. You know, not many people thought he could do that. He did that. And then, you know, those the two fights with Wilder, he really won them both. That they called one a draw, but you know, you were there, John. That is that astonishing, you know, getting up from that knockdown in the final round to win the fight. So, but it's quite a thin body of evidence, really, with Fury, isn't it? Set against everything that Lennox did over a decade or so. So there's that to weigh into it.
Well, he got up off the canvas, didn't he, to get a draw in a fight that I think virtually everybody at ringside thought he'd won. Yeah. And then there was the change of tactics for the two fights which followed against Deontay Wilder, the change of trainer, Ben Davison jettisoned, in comes Sugar Hill Stewart. He becomes an altogether more physical force, and he won both those rematch fights and won them both emphatically, ultimately.
Yeah, they've both beaten everyone they faced. Obviously, Fury's unbeaten, but the only draw on his record, he's beaten Wilder twice as well as the draw. There was the one where he absolutely cleaned him out in 7 or 8 rounds, and then they had that thrilling fight of the year, the up and downer in Vegas to close out the trilogy. It's tough, isn't it? I mean, Ian, when you look at eras, I mean, Lennox didn't just clear out his era with Holyfield and Tyson, although he never got the bow fight, but he made a good dent in the next era with David Tua, Haseem Rahman and Vitali Klitschko. I mean, it's almost the sort of thing that you wouldn't see today where someone actually starts going through the next crop as well. I mean, it's staggering what Lennox did.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, he did beat Riddick Bowe, didn't he, in the Olympic final, and Bowe never wanted to know about him again. That's why we never saw that, I think, as a professional fight. But yeah, I mean, Lennox, I think, would be really... I think he had different levels of motivation for fights. He took his eyes off the ball when he lost that fight to Rahman and put that right in emphatic fashion in the rematch. I mean, for a fight with Tyson Fury, his juices really would be flowing, I think. And Lennox was a pretty hard guy to get the better of over 12 rounds. He always seemed to find the key to outboxing his opponent. He did just enough to win. Great boxing brain. Fury has one as well. So it really would be an interesting strategic battle between them. But Lennox's long record of success, I'm leaning his way.
John, let me ask you this. So there's something I wanted to ask you, actually, John. With regards to Lennox, well, Fury did Klitschko up in knots, didn't he, with the psychological battle. Klitschko didn't know if he was coming or going. I don't think Fury would get into Lennox's head one bit. Lennox would be just chilled out, doing his own thing, playing his chess with the soft music and all the reggae in the background. I don't think he would have got into Lennox's mind at all, John.
Well, Mike Tyson tried to do it to Lennox, didn't he? And he wasn't having any of it. When it comes to, everybody always sort of looks at Lennox and sees him as this kind of gentle giant who was they called him a mummy's boy, didn't they? His mother, Violet, sadly, incidentally, died recently. So our thoughts were very much with Lennox and his family in their bereavement there. But he was never a softy, never. He was one very, very hard man. And I don't think that any amount of bullshit from, sorry, if you pardon the phrase, any amount of bull from Tyson Fury in his camp, I don't think it would have made a dent on Lennox.
Do you remember when Lennox, to underline your point there, was at that press conference in Las Vegas, and Don King and Mike Marley, who I think was his PR guy at the time, were trying to undermine Frank Maloney. They were trying to get Lennox to come over and sign for Don King in a pretty ham-fisted way, and they were doing it at the press conference. And eventually Lennox just chimed in and said, "Shut up, Don." He said, I'm sick of hearing this. Frank Maloney's the best boxing manager in the world, and that's the end of the conversation here. And I thought, he's steely. He was icy, Lennox. Nothing was going to get to him, I don't think, psychologically.
Well, I spoke to Haseem Rahman recently on the Boxing Life Stories, and he was great talking about Lennox in that rematch. And he was full of praise, said Lennox hit him harder than anybody else. And, he's fought everyone, Rahman, through the eras. And Lennox obviously absolutely cleaned him out. I think that was when you talk about motivation, there was never a more switched on Lewis who'd come in substantially lighter, was lighter on his toes, could move so gracefully, but then he still kept that power where he absolutely leveled Rahman.
Yeah, I remember the Galotta knockout as well, when I think, he was pumped up for that as well. Yeah, that Rahman fight, I remember. Lennox used to be a bit funny around the fights. He had this contract where he did a sit-down interview with us ahead of every fight. And he'd always come in and sit down and say nothing, even though I'd interviewed him 100 times, and just get on and do the interview and go away again because he was 4 days out from a fight. This time, he came and sat down opposite me. And before we switched on the tape and started the interview, he tapped me on the knee and said, there won't be any defeat this time. And it's the only time he'd ever said anything ahead of the interview. So I thought, crikey, this is over. He's going to wipe this guy out. And of course, that's exactly what he did. So that just underlines, his fire was raging inside ahead of that Rahman fight.
And what a puncher he was as well, Ian. You talk about that Rahman fight. That was phenomenal performance. But, I think back at other wins you mentioned Galotta. Galotta, incidentally, was truly intimidated to the point of almost having a nervous breakdown against Lennox Lewis. What about Grant as well? Michael Grant, who is being touted as the new big thing. And Lennox just went in there and absolutely demolished him. And when he fought Tommy Morrison in Atlantic City, that was one brutal, brutal fight. And he absolutely demolished Morrison over, what, five or six rounds or whatever it was. And he just took him apart. I think at his best, Lennox Lewis would have been a handful for any heavyweight who ever lived. And I think he'd have. I think there is an argument that he might be the best of all time. He certainly has a huge punch power. I think he's a bigger puncher than Deontay Wilder. And I think that if Wilder could get to Tyson Fury, I think that somebody with the technical ability of Lennox Lewis most definitely would have done. And he'd have had the power to get to Fury, put him on his back, and I think to have finished him.
By the way, when you're talking about dramatic Lennox Lewis knockouts, you know, remember you would have done this for Sky, I'm sure, actually. Franz Botha in London. Do you remember that?
Well, that was, I think that was another one where, I mean, Franz Botha with his South African background, Lennox wanted to get rid of him and he got rid of him. And that Michael Grant fight, you remember, Michael Grant was a bit of a darling of HBO. They were looking for an American heavyweight, and they thought here was their man. And Lennox had wind of that as well. And I knew that fight was over 2 days before the day before the weigh-in at Madison Square Garden. And afterwards, we're walking through the corridors, and Grant is sitting there with a haunted look on his face, kneeling on the floor with his head in his hands. And me and Bob Meehan walking past him, and thought, oh my God. I mean, what is going through his head? He had the look of a man thinking, what have I got myself in for here? And of course, he was blown away in two rounds.
John, by the way, there's an elephant in the room here.
Is there?
Yeah. Tyson Fury's last fight, he barely managed to win over a debutant and climbed off the floor to do it against Francis Ngannou. How does that change his legacy?
Well, if we're going to talk about that, I think if you look at Tyson's fights, I think the peak Tyson Fury was the second Deontay Wilder fight. And I think that all his fights since then, you could argue, have been flawed in one way or another. And I think that the evidence of your eyes, and again, this is hugely contentious, I realise that, and it might explode in my face having said it, but the evidence of your eyes is that Tyson Fury may not be the fighter that he was three to 4 years ago, and that that Ngannou fight against a man so technically limited, but physically in great shape, underlined the fact that Tyson Fury is not the fighter he once was.
Well, or I don't know, or do you give him a free pass for that because it was such a kind of, I don't know, didn't seem like a real fight. I mean, it turned into one, but, you know, he made it that and came a close thing in the end. But was Tyson Fury properly prepared and wound up mentally for that? I'm prepared to kind of look at that as a bit of false form.
If he's been cutting corners in preparations, you know, with this Usyk fight coming up in February, there is absolutely no way he needs to cut any corners whatsoever in preparation for that, because you know Usyk is superbly fit and, you know, and he calls him an ugly little middleweight and all the rest of it, but that's rubbish. He's 6 foot four and a half, 16 and a half stone, and he is another guy who is hard as nails. Fury will need to produce the performance of his career if he's going to win that.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
Maybe we'll break that one down.
Corners. I don't think he will cut corners. I think you'll see a different Tyson Fury mentally and physically for that fight.
I think we should maybe do a big preview of that when the time comes. But, John, where are we then? Lennox versus Fury, neck on the line.
Well, I underline what I said in analysis, that I think that Lennox Lewis was a great, great puncher. He had off nights. He had certain people who gave him trouble. Obviously, he lost to McCall. He lost to Rackman, but he won rematches. struggled against Ray Mercer in a fight that he wasn't really up for. Mercer, by the way, a very underrated heavyweight in his own right. But I think that the best of Lennox Lewis, when he found those huge punches, and he was a serious puncher, I think he'd have got to Tyson Fury. I think he'd have landed the bombs as Deontay Wilder did, but I think that'd have been more accurate, more telling, and I go for Lewis knockout in seven.
Ian?
I think Tyson Fury would have had his moments in the fight, but I think Lennox is better, and I think I've got Lennox Lewis by decision or late stoppage.
It's interesting. I don't envisage fireworks. I don't envisage it being a heavyweight Hagler Hearns by any stretch. I couldn't imagine a very cagey chess match with Lennox being a bit more active, but ultimately, you know, when you see when Fury's defensively on it, he's very good and he's great with his trip hammer feinting and everything else. But he has over the years been a sucker for that overhand right. And I don't know that anyone's thrown a better overhand right in history than Lennox. It's a devastating shot. And I just think Fury with that low left hand and Lennox with that overhand right, at some point, it's going to connect. And Lewis, like we've said, is spiteful, could finish, and could get the job done. And for me, it's a Lennox stoppage somewhere between 8 and 10 rounds. Unless Lennox, as he did against David Tua, although he never really put his foot on the floor, takes his foot off the gas and coasts, having had Fury down. So I'm going for Lennox stoppage 8 or 9, in between 9 and 10 rounds. But I could see him hurting Fury, dropping him a couple of times and coasting to a safe win.
So we've got a unanimous one for Lennox here.
We do. We do.
Nobody cares, do they? Nobody cares. It's just us talking.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Hey, this is the sort of thing, isn't it? This is the sort of thing that, you know, it. Like I said at the start, you can't take it too seriously, but it does make you wonder, doesn't it? When you see some of these guys, and, you know, certainly if they're in the modern era, if some of these guys not fighting each other, you just think, well, if they're not fighting each other, we may as well play dream fights with people from previous generations.
Well, yeah. Boxing fans have been doing this, haven't they, for years, as we all have around various bars around the world, chatting over the fights. This would have been a pretty good bill, wouldn't it?
Well, we've mentioned it before, by the way. You know, remember the computer fight between Muhammad Ali and Marciano?
Yeah.
You know, there's been, you know, people have always wanted to know who's the best and, you know, who's pound for pound and all the rest of it. These are discussions that make the world go round. And I mean, it happens in football, doesn't it? Wenger's invincibles against Alex Ferguson's best lot from Old Trafford. You know, all the sports, we always think about this, whether it's the British Lions against, you know, the best Australian teams or the best Barbarians team ever. This is part of what being a sports fan is all about, I guess, John.
Yeah. And bottom line is that, you know, we might have made a few quid doing it over the years, but we are and will remain, I'm sure, to the end of our days, will remain boxing fans. I know I will.
Well, artificial intelligence might be able to get these fights on.
It might well be. We can watch them all on TikTok in years from now. So yeah. Brilliant. Well, gents, look, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I have really enjoyed it. It's proper fandom stuff for me. I've really enjoyed it. And some great fights there to debate. And I'm sure we can revisit these if people want to send in their comments and we can put the world to right with some dream fights. But gents, that's all for me. From me, Tris Dixon, from Ian Dark and John Rawling. We'll be back soon on Ringside Rewind.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.